Why you are busy enjoying your lunch, why you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening, we ask what's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis. Thank you for choosing Eagle FM, the home of insightful conversations and real national dialogue. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and this is On the Reading News Analysis, where headlines meet context. Now, it's Thursday, the 27th of November, 2025. And as the week continues to unfold, Namibia finds itself navigating a mix of progress, pressure, and possibility. Now, across our towns, regions, and institutions, important decisions are being made, decisions that will shape our communities, our economy, and our everyday lives. Now, in this program, we don't just report the news. We unpack the dynamics behind the headlines, explore the implications for ordinary Namibians, and ask the critical questions that matter to you, from Windhoek to Katima Mulilo, from Rhodes to Rundu. From 1300 hours to 1430, Monday through Friday, On the Radar connects you to the issues driving the national conversation with expert insights, community voices, and journalism that seeks not just to inform, but to empower. Now, this edition will bring key developments into sharper focus, giving you the background, the facts, and the perspective needed to understand the bigger picture. You can tune in via all Eagle FM frequencies, stream us via the Eagle FM app, or the Eagle FM website, and download the Eagle FM app and stay connected through our WhatsApp channel for updates, polls, and exclusive content. So settle in, whether you are on the road, at work, or listening from home, and stay with us. This is where Namibia pauses, reflects, and engages with its future. Now let's get right into these top stories. Today at the Information Sharing Center, the shared on overcoming the disruption and transforming the AIDS response. Let's take a listen, and I'll come in to explain in detail afterwards.
Great. So HIV is the virus, and this virus, someone can get it through different ways, and most of the time through it's part of the sexual transmitted infections. So when the virus is in the body, it will attack what you call the CD4 count. And the CD4 counts are taken like body soldiers. When it attacks our CD4 counts in the body, and it will use the CD4 count to replicate. Mm-hmm. Once the virus uses the CD4 count to replicate, the CD4 count will die. Once the CD4 count die, so the body immunity, the number of CD4 counts in the body will decrease. And once this CD4 decreases, it will make the body immunity become very low or poor, and allow any other disease to come in. And the effect of this low immunity and allowing other disease to come in will create what we call AIDS. Mm-hmm. So the consequence of the virus in the body, by decreasing the body immunity and other disease coming in the body, and create what we call AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Staying with Dr. Kamangu, let's start with our first theme, which is global level. Why was the global theme, Overcoming Disruption, Transforming the AIDS, a response, chosen for World AIDS Day? And what does it signify for the global HIV response?
Great. There have been a significant disruption in terms of the HIV service delivery. And this theme was chosen to respond directly to the global scale down in terms of international donor fundings. So over the past years, the international donor have funding HIV service delivery across the world by supporting the HIV treatment, HIV prevention care, as well as other service delivery.
Mm-hmm.
So with the recent cut in terms of funds, it has severe affecting countries in terms of for the HIV response.
Mm-hmm.
And this has put a lot of pressure in countries' health system and disrupt the services, with a risk of losing what we have gained so far in terms of for HIV response in different countries in the world. And this theme also highlights the need of stop depending or over-reliance on external donor funded. And it's a call for countries now to develop sustainable strategy for HIV prevention by resource mobilizing, financing, build a resilience HIV response. So it's also emphasized on the country looking at domestic resources in order for us to sustain what we gained so far and close the gap by the Vision 2030. So this theme is also a call to everyone, to countries, to make sure that to end aid by 2030, it needs a collaborative effort. It needs sustainable financing and also including HIV response in a broader health system in the country.
Okay. Dr. Kamangu, in what ways can partnerships between governments, donors, NGOs, and the private sector be leveraged to accelerate progress towards ending AIDS by 2030?
So great. Yeah, the HIV response is a multi-sector intervention, which collaboration and partnership is crucial for countries to achieve the target or to end aid, as we have this target of ending aid by 2030. So if there's no that collaboration, it will be very difficult to achieve those targets. So the government, for the Republic of Namibia, through the Ministry of Health Services, is the custodian of the health service delivery in the country. So the government need to ensure that services are available, accessible without any economical strength. And the government must put policy and framework in place which make this service accessible to the community or to the beneficiaries. And top of that, the government has infrastructure and budget allocated for these services. So donors can come in with their expertise and the resources and funds to support what the government is already doing. And the NGOs, such as also civil society organization, play also a role by engaging the community level through advocacy, education, and empowering the community to come forth in the fight against HIV/AIDS. We have also private sector can play a big role by come up with innovative way to keep the employee away of the HIV status, relationship status, aware about different service delivery such as HIV prevention, HIV care and treatment, and also to allow a work platform which continuously deliver message on HIV so that employee can use services available. So for this, they can also contribute to the fight against stigma and discrimination, which affect the response to HIV. The HIV response is framed within the broader national development agenda outlined in the National Development Plan 6, which we call the NDP-6. And this is a country 5 years strategic blueprint that serves as the final medium term plan to achieve the Vision 2030. So we also have our target to achieve by 2030. So it goes, together with the national development plan. So, one of the key, pillar for this NDP-6 is good governance and effective public service delivery. So this plan is supported by other frameworks such as the National Strategic Framework for HIV and AIDS, which has set some targets for us as a country, Namibia, to achieve by 2028 and to enable us to end it by 2030. So on top of this national strategic framework for HIV and AIDS, the government recently launched the roadmap, the sustainability roadmap for HIV, tuberculosis, virus, hepatitis, as well as malaria control, which is also is a document supporting the country how to sustain the gain and end it by 2030. So there is a strong need to maintain this achievement. So, as my colleagues mentioned, that the country stands at 96, 98, 98. These are great achievements, and we really need to maintain them so that we close the gap and make sure that come to 2030, we end it. So, the first things I'll mention is the implementation, full implementation, the sustainability roadmap for HIV, tuberculosis, viral hepatitis, as well as malaria control. So if we fully implement, we'll be able to achieve this, to maintain this achievement and close the gap. So the second thing is the implementation of the contract, social contract policy, which enable the civil society organization to work with the community to improve the quality of care. So these are the two things. But when you look at into the this achievement, the 96, 98, 98, and if you disaggregate the data, you find that there are some certain category of population are lagging behind. These are adolescent, children, young adults, as well as men. So we need to make sure that our services are integrated to reach the need of this population by intensifying HIV testing, especially among young girls and young boys, to cut the risk of HIV transmission by kind of coming up with HIV-friendly services to attract men to use the HIV services so that we close this gap as well. And also looking to the integration such as looking at HIV and mental health, which also affect people living with HIV in terms of adherence. And also with the aging, there are non-communicable diseases also are coming up. So looking at how we can integrate non-communicable diseases and HIV to give that comprehensive package of care. Based on the evidence, Namibia also has embedded into what we call HIV treatment optimization. This means that giving effective, simplified regimen to the majority of people living with HIV is what now Namibia is doing by providing that kind of treatment, which is very simple, fixed dose combination and effective to make sure that we sustain the viral suppression among people living with HIV. So on top of that, to strengthen again the adherence, so we are currently implementing what you call the multi-month prescription, which means every client who comes to the facility will receive a long prescription, which can be up to 6 months. And when they go to the pharmacy, they will receive also a supply of medication of 6 months. So this will enable them to stay at home, not to spend more time or frequently to come at the facility. So on top of that, there are other package, for example, for adolescent and younger adults who are also lagging behind. There's intervention like the peer support provided to them, which is psychosocial support, just to strengthen the adherence for them to remain on medication. So on the community part, the ministry have done a lot on the community part by bringing the service closer to the community with platforms such as the community adherence group. This is a group of patients. They share some common backgrounds where they select one of them as a leader who will be able to collect their medication at the facility and distribute to them. And also the ministry have also extend the services through the what we call the community health post. These are structures establishing the communities to bring the service closer to the community as well as the primary health care. So the community play a crucial role. So without the involvement of the community, fighting HIV, it's a lost. So community, they play a big role in terms of supporting each other, in terms of educating each other, as well as accepting that HIV is a reality and accepting that HIV service is available and free of charge. So community have been playing a very crucial role in terms of involving in the different campaign we have been conducting in terms of HIV prevention, like the voluntary medical circumcision community have been on front for this. And there are other campaigns like the U equals to U, which you call undetectable, equal to untransmittable. So community have been playing a big role by displaying the message in the community to encourage those who are taking the medication to suppress the viral load so that we can apply what we call U equals to U. And they have a different network of people living with HIV in the community. They also support other people living with HIV within the community to remain on treatment and take their medication. So with this role, it's key for the country to achieve the target. And without the community, we are not going to win. This year, as we mentioned, the commemoration will be done, will be done in Chivarongo. Despite that, the commemoration will be done in Chivarongo. There are other, you know, region also will join by commemorating this event. Like for Comas region, the Comas region is planning to commemorate the event in Grootop on the 12th for build-up activities and on the 13th, I think, for the main event. So this is a call for everyone just to reflect on the gain Namibia had achieved so far in terms of the HIV response, while noting the remaining challenges to close the gap and aid by 2030. So everyone counts, every effort counts, everyone contribution counts for us to achieve the goal. So together we can sustain the HIV response, we can fight stigma as well as discrimination, and build a resilient team where we have a community where HIV is no more a concern, where HIV transmission will be almost like to zero.
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Koyo, any parting shots before we conclude?
Yes. This is just to encourage the Namibian people to get tested so they know their status. If they know their status and they happen to be HIV positive and are still thinking about whether or not they should start treatment, we encourage to start treatment. And those that are on treatment are once again encouraged.
And that's the voice of Dr. Jacques Kamangu. He is the HIV Chief Clinical Mentor, Directorate of Special Programs in the Ministry of Health and Social Services. And the last voice there was of Teopolina Kuyeo. She's the Senior Coordinator of UNAID. Now, overcoming disruptions in the AIDS response. Now, in recent years, global health systems, including HIV and AIDS programs, have faced major disruptions, being pandemics like the COVID-19 that diverted resources away from the HIV treatment and prevention, as well as conflicts and humanitarian crisis that displaced communities and interrupted access to the medicine. Also, economic instability, which leads to funding gaps for essential health programs. Imagine if there is a war in a country, instead of them, their major worry will not be to focus on HIV programs, but rather to focus on care for the people, those that are injured in the war, as well as to trying to feed them, as people, these people usually have hunger issues. Now, overcoming disruption means strengthening systems so that care continues even during crisis. And this includes decentralizing services, expanding community-led care, and ensuring supply chains for HIV medicines remain resilient. The global HIV response is shifting from a purely medical approach to a holistic, more people-centered model. Now, transformation involves integrating HIV care with other healthcare services, for example, sexual and reproductive health, as well as mental health. Also providing services where people already are. That is finding them in the schools, in the community centers, at the pharmacies, just where people already are. Also using digital tools for testing and treatment reminders, as well as monitoring. The goal is to modernize systems so that they reach everyone, so that they're accessible to everyone and not just people with access to clinics. Breaking barriers. Now, many of the challenges in ending AIDS are not medical, but rather social. Barriers include stigma and discrimination. And even though in an era like this, stigma and discrimination still exist towards those who are HIV positive. For instance, there are some people who say that, who advocate for people who are HIV positive not to get married, not to have a lifetime partner. But that's not way actually, that's not identifying or trying to give a problem to the solution. That's not identifying the root. also criminalization of key populations and gender inequality, poverty and lack of education. Still, there needs to be, although much, I think much has been done in terms of educating in regards to HIV and AIDS, but maybe we are now still now letting it go and not really talking about it. But education is quite of paramount, as people still need to be taught that HIV doesn't mean a death sentence. Also, poverty plays its role, whereby a person is taking their medication and don't really have the nutrition that they need, which they actually need in order to help them in their immune system to get better, opposed to just taking the medication on a hungry stomach or having a diet that is just same staple food over and over again. Also, there is limited youth access to sexual health services. Now, breaking those barriers means creating legal, social, and cultural environments where people feel safe and supported in seeking help, not just from their immediate family members, but by the community themselves, by everybody playing their part, but also by sustaining access to care. Even with progress, millions still lack consistent access to HIV prevention and treatment. Now, sustaining access means ensuring lifelong availability of ART, that is antiretroviral therapy, and expanding PrEP or PEP, self-testing as well, harm reduction services as well, funding community-led programs. And I believe the most programs, of course, other programs that are not community-based make their impact in the communities, but community-led programs are at the grassroots level. They're the ones that sometimes even know name by name and household by household on how many people are actually on ARV treatment and how many people need care, how many people need still encouragement, and how to reach out to those people. So funding those community-led programs is one major way to actually ensure that disruptions to those programs is hindered. Also, training healthcare workers and strengthening clinics and outreach programs. The core of the idea is ending AIDS is impossible without continuous, reliable care for everyone at risk or in living with HIV. And at risk means also children whose mom is HIV positive and perhaps they care for the mom. And in case anything happens, such as a cut, those children need to be educated that don't touch mommy with a wound with your bare hands. Because if you have a wound and then you touch mommy with her wound, that HIV can be transmitted to you. So, and even if it's not specifically spelling out the words for that little one who maybe, maybe that 7-year-old who may not really, is not ready to be told that mommy has HIV and AIDS, but rather just making them to be cautious so as to be very careful even when they are around, that particular, parent or that particular adult who has the disease. Now, ending AIDS requires a broader transformation of health and social systems. It requires universal health coverage, community leadership and involvement, equitable resource distribution, stronger public health infrastructure, policy guided by human rights and evidence. Now, the systemic changes don't just improve HIV outcomes, they improve health outcomes for entire populations. Driving progress towards ending AIDS for all. The ultimate goal is to reach the 95 to 95 targets. The 95% of people with HIV knowing their status. The 95% of those diagnosed are on treatment. The 95% of those on treatment are virally suppressed. Now, Namibia is doing fairly well in this goal, as we are in our 90s, but we're still striving to be exact on those targets. Now, progress for all means eliminating discrepancies so no group is left behind. No young women, not the young, not the women, not the communities, not people who use drugs or people in low income or conflict affected areas. Everyone needs to be incorporated. So the phrase reflects a vision of a future where disruptions don't derail HIV services. Barriers, whether legal, social or geographical, are not dismantled. Access to care is universal and sustainable. Health systems are stronger, more resilient, and more fair. So the transformation is essential to achieving the global community in order to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030. Now, with that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly with more right here on the Radar News Analysis.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
the eye. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho tike kovano ile koshiwala kono ngeshefa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu honda doi inawa nene udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarude dayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijabu ili nawa ninge pata fano na monika ko Eagle FM onmura isatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali Ileko berewa, mura hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Now, in other news, the Ministry of International Relations and Trade, in collaboration with the Ministry of Industry, Mines and Energy, has been rolling out a set of series of regional business engagement aimed at deepening Namibia's integration into the African Continental Free Trade Area. They have been in Otapi, Oshakati, Omuthia, as well also they first started off in Opuwa. Now, according to the ministries, these engagements are designed to create a platform for direct dialogue between government and the business community, including small and medium-sized enterprises, also known as SMEs. Now, the discussions focused on identifying export-ready businesses, enhancing competitiveness, and aligning national trade policies with continental objectives under the AFCFTA, or the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. The initiatives underscores government's commitment to strengthening public-private collaboration and ensuring that Namibian enterprises are well-positioned to seize emerging opportunities within the African market. Through the regional consultations, officials aim to gather crucial feedback from the business sector, addressing existing challenges and promoting sustainable trade practices that can drive inclusive economic growth. The AFCFTA, once fully operational, is expected to create the world's largest free trade area, connecting 1.3 billion people across 55 countries with a combined gross domestic product of over $3 trillion. Namibia's active participation is therefore seen as pivotal to expanding market access, boosting exports, and strengthening regional value chains. Let's now take a listen to Francisca Kupembona.
A part of this ceremony, we are able to view the stalls and view all other products and services that are being exhibited here. So as an organizing committee, we are really, really grateful that under his leadership, we have managed to pull through this mammoth task, a great event that we celebrate today. This platform continues to serve as a shining example of a strategic decision and serves as a platform to discuss the importance of local economic development and what are our roles on how we can collectively contribute to the growth of our beloved town of Rundu and our country Namibia as well. Ladies and gentlemen, what started in the early 2000s as Kavango Summer Festival by private individuals in collaboration with the former Rundu Urban Constituency Councillor, Honorable Nimrod Mureni, for those of us that have been around, we do know him, and we will cherish his initiative, and that brought about the birth of the Rundu Annual Trade Fair, which we started organizing as from 2016. This event has grown from a small community exhibition into a major regional event that attracts business, investors, government ministries, and visitors from all parts of Namibia and neighboring countries. Year on year, we continue to make significant strides in terms of attraction to the trade fair. In this regard, we are pleased to report that this year we have managed to attract 206 stalls that have been occupied by 168 exhibitors compared to last year where we had 133 exhibitors.
Also speaking at the event is Vice President of the Republic of Namibia, Lucia Betboy.
The commercial hub and capital of the Kavango East region, but also one of Namibia's fastest growing towns and gateway of commerce and cooperation. Strategically located along the mighty Kavango River and neighboring the Angolan town of Calais. The town's potential in agribusiness, tourism, culture, logistics, housing, fisheries, renewable energy, and manufacturing is vast. With continued investment, Rundu can become a regional hub of trade and development that benefits not only the people of this region, but the entire Namibian nation. The government of the Republic of Namibia remains steadfast in supporting initiatives that drive our economic development. That's why I am here today, as I said, we had a very hectic programs, but I just decided I cannot cancel or ask the governor to stand in for us. So that's why I make efforts to be, because I said I cannot disappoint my people, my Namibian people, my Kavango people. That's why I'm here. We recognize that sustainable growth begins at the grassroots in our towns, villages, and communities. Through platforms like the Rundu Annual Trade Fair, we strengthen our local economies, promote entrepreneurship, create employment, and stimulate cross-border trade. These are the building blocks of resilience, prosperity, and national unity. I therefore call upon the business community to seize the opportunity that this trade fair presents. Let us innovate, collaborate, and invest in the industries that will transform our economy and improve the livelihood of our families and our people. We would also like to encourage the regional leadership to ensure that this trade fair is supported wholeheartedly, as it not only benefits the local economy of the town, but to a larger extent, the region itself. It is through these opportunities that jobs are created and the livelihood of our communities is improved. To our exhibitors, I encourage you. So next year we must have more than 206. From last year we have increased, so let us increase 250 to 300 next year. Ne? Sama sir. So, number one, I encourage you to showcase the best of your talents, products, and innovations. The main goals of trade fairs are to promote products and services, create business connections, very important, create business connections and increase sales. While you are there at your store, don't just stay there. It's opportunities to connect. Visit the next store, visit the other one, visit the other one. Ask questions so that when you close, you connect the dots. It also provides a platform for entrepreneurs to showcase their goods, launch new products, and strengthen their brand image. Therefore, let your work inspire others.
Now, the Africa Continental Free Trade Area is one of the largest trade opportunities ever created for African nations, and Namibian businesses stand to gain significantly by taking an active role. One FCFTA, the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, opens doors for Namibian companies to sell their products and services across the continent with fewer barriers. Instead of relying mainly on local or regional markets, businesses can expand their customer base dramatically, boosting sales, attracting investment, and driving growth. With tariff reductions and simplified custom procedures, Namibian goods become more competitive across Africa. This means lower export costs, better profit margins, and increased opportunities for small and medium enterprises to enter new markets. It also encourages industrialization and value addition, as the Africa Continental Free Trade Area promotes producing and processing goods within Africa rather than exporting raw materials to outside countries or outside Africa. For Namibia, this creates incentives to develop manufacturing, agro-processing, logistics, and renewable energy industries, leading to job creation and stronger economic resilience. Given Namibia's strategic ports at the Walvis Bay and Ruderitz, it strengthened Namibia's position as a logistic hub. The country is well positioned to become a gateway for goods moving across the continent. Increased continental trade can expand the transport, logistics, warehousing, and shipping sectors. It also promotes innovation and competitiveness, as exposure to larger markets encourages businesses to improve product quality, modernize operations, adopt new technologies, strengthen branding and marketing, which helps Namibian businesses compete not just regionally but globally. It therefore creates new partnerships and investment opportunities, as the AFCFTA encourages cross-border collaboration. Namibian businesses can form joint ventures, attract investors, and build supply chain partnerships or partners with companies in other African countries, therefore opening up opportunities that were previously out of reach. It also supports economic diversification, as participation in the AFCFTA helps Namibia reduce its reliance on a few sectors such as mining, and by unlocking markets for the agriculture, manufacturing, tourism, and creative industries and services, Namibia strengthens economic stability and long-term growth. But overall, for Namibia participating in the AFCFTA, it's not just an economic opportunity. It is a strategic necessity. It helps businesses to grow. It creates jobs, attracts investment, and positions the country as a competitive player in Africa's rapidly expanding market. Namibian businesses that embrace the Africa Continental Free Trade Area early will be better placed to lead in the future, drive national development, and contribute to a more integrated prosperous continent. And with that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. This is On The Reader News Analysis. We'll be back with news beyond the borders. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? Any person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? Any person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
Ipuranenge no wapungwa eva tere wikoni mandu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete okoye ekukulile oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota enjuka okupitira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nene uto otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka okone ushendi fenawa nokumuna oijawiri nawa ninge pata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onora esatimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu o mafilane Eagle FM di ae.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? Any person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
Welcome back, and now it's time for news beyond the borders of Namibia. We're starting off in South Africa, whereby the annual science forum is taking place, and good things are in place as to invent things such as smart wheelchairs.
For Scientific and Industrial Research, or CSIR, in Pretoria. It's hosted by the Department of Science, Technology and Innovation, and the Science Forum celebrates 10 years of insightful dialogue, making this year more significant. Let's cross to Sakina. She's there, and she's having the time of her life. Sakina, what have you found now?
Leanne, I told you I'm going to find something interesting because it's all about the innovation. And this year, of course, it also coincides, generally does at the same time of this year, with Disability Awareness Month. And as you can see, I am sitting in a wheelchair and we're going to show you what this does. And hopefully my dress doesn't get in the way of progress, scientific innovation here. So this is, of course, something that was invented by the Central University of Technology in the Free State. And I am not doing anything, Leanne. As you can see, the chair is moving, and it of course speaks to people who may be differently abled and what they can actually do. So I'm joined now, as you can see, the team here from the Central University of Technology who came up with this great innovation, and their Professor Alicia Marcus joins me. Professor, if you could just step up closer and of course talk to us about this innovation and what inspired it.
Thank you, Sakina. This is Musamai. Musamai means to walk. So it's a smart wheelchair that was designed to assist people with different disabilities, especially cognitive impairments. So Musamai can actually assist you to walk, to even dance. So how it works is that it leverages on AI for diagnostics because you are able to communicate with the wheelchair. It also leverages on IoTs, which are sensors. So the sensors are supposed to help you to communicate with the wheelchair. So as you can see, you're able to move because there's a communication between the sensor and the wheelchair. So the user is able to communicate with the wheelchair via sensors.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating because you were showing me earlier, you know, as you say, people who have different abilities to actually communicate with the technology in this chair can do different things. And I believe you had a device there that helped me to move it. So this is absolutely mind-blowing. And Paul, you were showing me earlier, so let me exchange one device for another. And this one, ooh, let me handle it with care because as I touch it, the wheelchair starts to move. So literally moving it back, stop. I hope you can see this, Leanne. Look at that. Put it forward. And it scares me a little bit. But, you know, this is, of course, the team that has worked on this as I try to get out. And, you know, it's a fascinating, fascinating chair. And I can only imagine how many people will be helped as a result of this. And it's super comfortable as well. So how long did you guys work on this, Prof? And I'll speak to the team in a short while.
Yeah. So we've been working on this now for 6 years. We work mostly with the community. So in Bloemfontein, there's a community called APD, Association of Persons with Disabilities. So we've been working with them very closely, also hearing from them what are their challenges and what are their needs, so that we design the technology to suit their needs. So we've been working on this for 6 years now.
Fascinating. Now, let me come over to the student side of things, the team. Talk to us, Paul and Henry and everybody. What did you do? What is it that you found most fascinating that attracted you to this?
So, as Prof had said, we've been working on this for the past 6 years or so, and it's been hands-on. So they are currently students at the Central University of Technology. I've been mentoring them into this, you know, just how to get AI started, how to build robotics. Robotics is very fascinating. So what we do is try and engage them as much as possible, you know, into getting, you know, into artificial intelligence and robotics. So this project, Prof came and, you know, we tried to look at how we can try and assist the disabled people or people with disabilities. And when we looked at how they are, it's quite a spectrum of people. So simply, you can't really, you know, just use a wheelchair for every single individual. So sometimes, you know, there's people with certain disabilities that you need to aim for. That's what we've been trying to look at. So can we put sensors? We've been looking at different sensors. So as you saw now, we use the cell phone. Currently, it's the most reliable one that we use, where you can increase the sensitivity. And then we have sensors that you can mount on the person's body as well that allow the wheelchair to move with the person as well. So that allows you to then free, you know, your hands, if you, you know, for some people who are unable to use their hands as well, they can use other parts of the body to still be able to, you know, drive the wheelchair. So as I said, it's been a very long journey for the past 6 years that we've been trying to develop these systems. So I think now we're just trying to look into commercializing it and, you know, making it an actual product that people can find on the market as well.
Well, I can tell you it works. And there's another one here on the side. There's a lot going on. The team is working on quite a number of things, Leanne. And
South Africa's police is investigate alleges South Africa recruits in Ukraine war.
Calls are mounting for a full investigation into South Africans who've been entangled in the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict. The South African Police Service has now confirmed that the Hawks are probing allegations that Duduzile Zuma Sambuja, who is an MP, played a role in recruiting young men to join the ongoing fighting. Let's speak more about this with Senior Training Coordinator with the Institute for Security Studies in Willem Els, who joins us now live. Willem, great to see you as always. Thanks very much indeed for making time. And we're hoping to gauge from you, as these investigations continue, how prevalent something like what we are potentially witnessing is, this idea of people being lured to places like Russia in order to be part of this war unknowingly.
Good morning to you, Ayanda. Yeah, as you mentioned, it's an ongoing affair. It's early days. The investigations are ongoing. So with the information that's available, it is concerning if we look at, you know, it seems to have a pattern where South Africans are being lured by these type of scams overseas to places like Thailand and Myanmar, but also to Russia with the previous incident. And now the allegations of these people being lured there under false pretenses. And then it seems that according to them, they ended up fighting a war that is not our war. Now, we must just understand that those actions have been criminalized by our legislation. So that is why it warrants a investigation into that. So we see also that the severity of the case is reflected by the CATS unit, that is the Crimes Against the State unit of the DPCI, that is actually investigating it.
Yeah, speak to us a bit more about what the law says, Willem, because I think many South Africans are learning about this potentially for the first time. You know, a very basic way to put it is that the law actually bars people from being part of any kind of mercenary groups and joining other wars, certainly not the wars that South Africa is not a part of.
Exactly. You know, traditionally where it comes from, you know, after 1994, there were a lot of South Africans that were lured into these mercenary organizations. They were fighting in countries like Liberia and other countries, other people's war, because of the expertise of the South Africans after the previous dispensation. So that prompted the drafting and the promulgation of this legislation that actually prevents South Africans from being recruited. So that's the first thing. Secondly, it prevents them from participating in another country's war, but also in other armed groups in those countries. So that has been said and done. And the problem that you have with those legislation, you know, we've had quite a few people that have been charged under that. And in the past, you got the option of a fine. So according to our information, everybody paid a fine and then it was forgotten about. So that is your challenge that you have with this case, is that this legislation has not been tested in court as yet, even though it has been on our books for some time. So that is the one thing. But also we must understand that in terms of the Human Trafficking Act, there are also charges being investigated according to our information, but also fraud. So those three will now be investigated. And at the end of the day, you know, the police is under pressure to do quite a decent and a thorough job on that. They will have to see whether there's a prima facie case. And at the end of the day, once they are satisfied, it will be handed over to the NPA, where they will determine whether they will prosecute or not. They will formulate the charges, and then it's all systems going for this case to go to court.
Yeah, you know, there's so much information flying around, documents, letters, we're told, purportedly from the MK party. I've heard a voice note of one of these men who are apparently stranded in Russia, and it's really difficult for them to kind of place who ought to be held accountable here. I wonder if you can speak to us a bit more about some of the security concerns that come up for you if, in fact, what we're being told is true?
Yeah, sure. You know, indications are that this is not the first group that has been going there far back, as according to some indications, as far back as 2015, 2016, some of the Africans went overseas abroad for this type of training. They came back. And of course, these people, when they come back, they've got additional skills. They got skills that can be used in some activities that might not be conducive for South Africa. So that is a challenge. You know, these people, should they be trained there and should they be participating in this war, and they come back with all of that experience and know-how and so on, it poses a serious challenge for us, because those people will have to be monitored, they will have to be investigated, but also, in order to monitor these type of people, it places a tremendous strain on our intelligence agencies in order to debrief and also to monitor them. So that is the fallout of that. We know that South Africa is under strain. Things are unstable at the moment, and we need to manage it quite well. Otherwise, it just might go south for us.
Absolutely. Well, Fulham Als, thanks very much indeed for speaking to us, especially considering, as you've been saying, how little we do know might be taking place there. Fulham Als with the Institute of Security Studies. For now, thanks very much indeed.
Zambia leads SADC cheek exports.
These are delegates from more than seven SADC countries that have convened here in Lusaka at this year's Poultry Future Forum to dialogue on the future of the industry in the region. Fisheries and Livestock Minister Engineer Peter Kapala graced the event.
Zambia takes pride in its position as a regional leader, particularly in the export of bear or chicks. This achievement reflects our commitment to competitiveness and innovation, positioning Zambia as a hub for poultry excellence in the region. Regional trade opportunities remain a foremost priority. The government is committed to creating an enabling environment to strengthen the domestic and regional poultry market.
Jonathan Saidi is Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA Vice President.
There has been a call by poultry associations across SADC and COMESA for a regional platform to enhance intra-regional trade, share intelligence, market management, intelligence coordinate on biosecurity, threats like avian influenza, salmonella, and others, and promote friendly trade.
Over the years, the sector has experienced significant growth, driven largely by a favorable business environment and strong government support. Notably, approximately 80% of our national poultry production is undertaken by small-scale farmers, highlighting the industry's critical role in empowering local communities and promoting inclusive economic participation.
This year's regional forum has been held under the theme From Vision to Action, Accelerating Investment and Impact in Southern Africa's Poultry Sector. I am Afto Banda, reporting in Lusaka.
5th and 2nd edition of the Zimbabwe-Zambia Energy Project Summit has opened in Livingston. Southern Province Minister Credo Nanjua officially opened the summit by underscoring progress made through Zambia's comprehensive energy reforms.
We continue to implement far-reaching reforms to ensure that our energy sector is modern, competitive, and attractive for private capital. These reforms are already yielding results, with more independent power producers entering the market, with more than 7,000 megawatts of power purchase agreements in place.
Zimbabwe's Deputy Energy Minister Yeokai Simbanegavi has called for deeper cross-border collaboration as the two countries push for private sector-driven energy projects.
We are also committed to developing priority transnational power generation infrastructure projects such as the Batoka Gorge Hydroelectric Scheme and other projects to support regional economic growth and increased generation.
And head of the Presidential Delivery Unit, Kusobile Kamwambi, says Zambia's economic targets depend on rapid energy expansion and a diversified power mix.
We are looking at energy not just as an enabler. We are looking at energy as the very foundation on which our economic transition lies as well. So the government is not seeing itself as a controller of the market, but as a catalyst and a steward for this strategic enabler called energy to be made possible.
In Zambia, our subsidiary ZenPower is investing in last mile and industrial distribution infrastructure to ensure power reliably reaches end users. These efforts are supporting manufacturing, mining, agro-processing, and local capacity development.
The summit, themed Mines and Energy, has drawn independent power producers, major infrastructure investors, regulators, utilities, financiers, contractors, and technology providers. Justin Akakulubelwa, ZNBC News, Livingston.
Meanwhile, Nairobi hotels shift out of the CBD as the city expands.
For decades, Nairobi city center has been a playground for diplomats, tycoons, and global deal makers. But that five-star sheen of the central business district is fading, and new developments are steering clear of the city center. I'm here to find out why. Just a few years ago, the hotel behind me was fully booked during international summits, but now its doors are shut and it's a symbol of a larger trend. In a 2.5 kilometers radius, another five high-end hotels have suffered the same fate or are struggling to stay afloat.
So where are these establishments and their clients moving to and why?
Upmarket Nairobi tends to be more secure compared to CBD and its peripherals, to be honest. And it's mostly because, again, it's a blue zone area. We're talking about blue zone areas.
The green leafy neighborhoods are less populated with fresh air and more space, unlike the CBD.
One of the key things that's actually driving this move towards the outside of the city is infrastructure development. Let's begin there. So that opens up new areas to new opportunities.
Itel Rachel Levy is a business traveler from Israel and runs a travel agency based in Tanzania. Nairobi is one of her clientele's top destinations.
But still, it is the best city, in East Africa, the best capital in East Africa for me, the most developed. If they pay, they need fancy rooms, good food, nice service, good service. Somebody to maybe to take them around if there is somebody from the hotel, or I provide somebody for them. But many of them need the luxury, and I'm talking about private families, honeymoon couples.
I caught up with an urban planner to understand what the link is between Nairobi city expansion, the emerging opportunities in the hospitality industry, and how they provide solutions to the needs of the high-end clients.
You need a particular amount of space to be able to tick a number of boxes that are critical for the hospitality industry, whether you look at the green space, the open spaces and so on, whether you look at environmental issues like providing for yourself your own power sources, or managing your own water systems and so on. Those are becoming increasingly difficult to do within the CBD. There's also the overall aspect of sustainability, where again, issues of urban pollution.
These are very difficult to now get within CBD locations. Your high-end traveler basically is a global traveler, and this is an individual who has standards and experiences from different parts of the world and so on. And they expect that when they're in these places, they will be able to get the same sort of service. So you find developers increasingly are saying, fine, why would I work so hard and not even meet these requirements because of locational issues, locational choices, while I can actually pick up locations that guarantee that I'll be able to meet a lot of these requirements.
A sanctuary for some, a squeeze for others. Nairobi stands at the crossroads of opportunity and inequality, the capital of East Africa and the capital of something much more complex. Reporting for CGTN in Nairobi, Kenya, I'm Wanja Mungai.
In other news, Donald Trump's decision counter productive to the U.S. image, says an analyst.
Of this moment, bring in now Emmanuel Matambo, a research director with the Center for Africa-Asia Studies, and joins us now via our video link. Great to have you on the SABC News Channel, sir. Thanks very much indeed for helping us make sense of these interesting times. And I wonder what you make as a start of how South Africa has responded to the U.S.'s stance, shall we call it, even though it's been conveyed via social media. I mean, if you just listen to the words, for example, that Vincent Magwenya uses about how South Africa doesn't take kindly to being insulted by another country, you certainly get a sense that there's a bit of the shift in the language.
Good morning, first of all, and good morning to your viewers. The shift in language actually preceded the current developments about South Africa not being invited to Miami next year, when it was decided by Donald Trump at the 11th hour that a charge d'affaires accepts South Africa's handing over of the G20 baton. Vincent Magwenya simply said the president will not hand over to a charge d'affaires. So already that could show that South Africa has kind of rediscovered its own respect, because there has been a lot of vacillation on the part of Donald Trump. When President Cyril Ramaphosa visited him in the White House, he did not give a definite answer on whether or not he was going to attend the G20. And then at another point, he said, well, he was willing to send J.D. Vance. And then he changed his mind, boycotted the entire conference, and then right at the end he now says, okay, then I'm going to send a diplomat of very low key standing compared to a president. And it was only right that President Cyril Ramaphosa puts his foot down. So the language that Vincent Magwenya has used is kind of paying Donald Trump in his own coin, so to say.
Right. And it's interesting because Donald Trump in that post described the charge d'affaires as a senior U.S. representative. So I guess here's another point where we disagree. Be that as it may, the sense I'm getting, Emmanuel, is that it doesn't seem the facts really matter. I mean, there have been so many instances where there was an attempt from South Africa to try at the very least clarify the facts. With that in mind, though, it's difficult to just shrug our shoulders because, let's face it, the decisions made by the U.S. president are consequential. You know, if, for example, he goes through with that promise to cut all aid to South Africa, it's not something we can really scoff at.
Well, I'll answer that. I'll respond in two sets here. The first set is the fact that what Donald Trump is doing is kind of counterproductive to the United States on global image. This is an image that has been painstakingly built for more than three quarters of a century, since the end of the Second World War and the beginning of the United Nations. And then when it comes to explaining really what has been happening towards South Africa, you realize that it is towards Donald Trump's own personal interest rather than the interest of the United States, because of people that have funded his re-election last year. These are Elon Musk and Miriam Adelson. These are people who have been vehemently against South Africa. Elon Musk, because of the impasse that he was in when he wanted to bring Starlink technologies here. Miriam Adelson was one of Trump's biggest campaign donors, and she's an Israeli-American physicist and a billionaire to boot. So it was not by coincidence that at the time when South Africa was taking the Israeli government to the International Court of Justice on genocide charges, Donald Trump again comes and accuses South Africa of genocide. And as you rightly put it, facts seem not to matter here according to what Donald Trump has been doing. Now, when it comes to the different component of your question there about funding, yes, indeed, South Africa deeply depends on American funding, especially when it comes to HIV/AIDS treatment. The South African Medical Research Council, earlier in the year, their president released a journal article in which she said that this is probably the time when South Africa needs to be self-sufficient in terms of funding HIV/AIDS program. Because to put this in context, between 2004 and 2020, the United States donated about $5.6 billion to South Africa under the rubric of the Presidential Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. So there would be really a body blow to South Africa if Donald Trump really carries through this and then withdraws all the funding that South Africa has been receiving for the last 20 years or something like that.
Many people will tell you that South Africa seems to have preempted this move. And if you look at kind of, I think it's the last paragraph of the declaration that was adopted at the weekend, there was a talk not only just of the presidency of the United States, but also that of the UK, and I think it's South Korea thereafter. You know, this idea that we all know that next year is going to be interesting, for lack of a better term, and the G20 will nonetheless continue thereafter. My question to you, though, Emmanuel, is what ought to be the response of the other G20 members if, in fact, the US finds a way of barring South Africa from attending this gathering in Miami through, I don't know, evoking visas, for example?
First of all, when it comes to the issue of revoking visas, I partly saw this coming, because remember that the Trump administration barred Palestinian diplomats from going to the, from attending the United Nations in person. So I expected something like this actually happening here. How can the rest of the G20 respond the way they responded to this year's G20? And that is by recommitting themselves to multilateralism. Donald Trump had already said that they were not going to endorse the declaration that would emerge from the G20. Why? Because they knew that the language that would come out of that declaration there would not be in keeping with the language that the United States has assumed since Donald Trump returned to the presidency. You have seen that in the Department of Defense, that is, has now been refashioned as the Department of War, they have been removing words such as equality, gender, DEI, and all that kind of stuff. So they were actually afraid that the declaration might have language like that. But as we have seen, the rest of the G20 seem to be matching in step, so to say, with South Africa. And this was even the case when it came to South Africa's stance on Israel, and that is why France, the United Kingdom, Canada even said they are now amenable to having a discussion about the existence of a Palestinian state. So I hope, though, that they are going to recommit themselves to multilateralism. As far as attending the conference next year is concerned, I would want a situation where they still attend that conference in Miami, but they still push back about the United States, trying to show the United States that on this particular matter, not on any other matter such as these spurious allegations of genocide in South Africa, the United States stands alone and does not enjoy the support of the rest of the G20.
Emmanuel Matumbo, as always, thanks very much indeed for your time. Really do appreciate the insights. Emmanuel is director of the Africa-Asia Studies. For now, thanks very much indeed.
Meanwhile, the Italian parliament has anonymously votes to make femicide a crime.
Add to Italy, where parliament voted unanimously to introduce femicide as a specific crime in the country's penal code. This is the moment parliamentarians approved the law with no votes against it. It will apply to all murders motivated by hatred, discrimination, domination, or subjugation of a woman because of her gender. The crime will now automatically trigger a life sentence. In a symbolic move, the vote marked the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, November the 25th. While latest figures show that in 2024, 116 women were killed in Italy. 106 of those are said to be motivated by gender. In recent years, one of the most high-profile cases was the murder of a student brutally stabbed to death by her ex-boyfriend in 2023 and later dumped by a lakeside. The crime shocked the country, triggering a wider debate on violence against women. Well, let's speak now to freelance journalist Silvia Boccardi in Milan, who has been closely following the story. Silvia, thank you very much for joining us on BBC News. How big a moment is this?
Well, it really depends on how you consider the law. So this new law actually strengthens penalties for murders committed in the context of domestic or gender-based violence. And as you were saying, it introduces measures such as life in jail for femicides. It is a bipartisan law, which is significant in a country where usually gender issues are often politically divisive. Some people see it as just symbolic because this law still focuses largely on reactive measures, protecting women after violence has occurred rather than preventing it. And Italy has historically seen opposition from especially the political right.
And with that, we have officially come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. To stay tuned for the Onkonana Dingi program brought to you by Louis Eshimi. As for me, Ndafa Happy Juju, I sign out at this point. And also do stay tuned for the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut from 16:30 and the Business Economic segment from 1800 Hours brought to you by David Shombe.